Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Bigfoot, is it real or is it a hoax?
For ages, he has hidden in the forest, eluded hunters, baffled scientists, and remained a mystery.
My entire life, I've seen shadow people.
For powerful and effective constipation relief.
Hello and welcome to the Don't Break the Oath podcast. Please subscribe if you can, if you haven't already. Leave an iTunes review if possible. That would really help us out. Right, so today is an interview with Ken Gahad. Now, some of you may already be aware of Ken. If you've watched things like Missing in Alaska, or if you're into cryptozoology, he's done a plethora of books on the subject. You know, from Mothman to everything, pretty much, cryptozoology-wise. So if you haven't already, you know, checked out that Missing in Alaska, it's definitely worth a watch. It was on the History Channel, but, you know, I enjoyed it, so it's definitely worth a watch, I'd say. I have to say a big thank you to Ken, actually, because I sat down to do the interview and everything, the mixer, for whatever reason, just wouldn't work. The day before, it was working fine. Sat down, and all of a sudden, it didn't work. So brilliant. But he stuck it out, you know. He could have told me to fuck off at any time because it's probably 15 minutes pissing about. But now he sat there and he doing the old testing and all that shit. So yeah, big kudos to him. Thank you very much for sticking that out. And you know, he is one of my favourite guys in the cryptozoology field. So yeah, it was a pleasure to speak to him. Now I'm going to have him back on again because obviously, like I say, there was a few technical issues that. You know, during that interview, so it made it difficult, but we'll have to speak to him again at some point. But I hope you enjoyed today's show. That being said, I hope you had a great Christmas. Ours went pretty smooth and pretty good. A couple of bottles of rum in there, so, and obviously it is New Year's Eve today, so Happy New Year. And it hadn't even started yet, and I've already been reading messages about how Nostradamus predicted the end of the world in 2018. So we've got that to look forward to. You know, but that happens every year, apparently, doesn't it? So we all know that. Anyway, I'm rambling. So here is the interview with Ken Gahad. I hope you enjoy it. And like I say, if you get a chance, check us out on Facebook. It is the, just type Don't Break the Oath podcast. I think it's Paranormal Hangout. But if you just type Don't Break the Oath podcast into Facebook, you will find us. Come and say hello. We are available there if you want to PM us, if you've got a story or whatever, or if, you know, general question. So, yep, we are there. So, without further ado, give you Ken Gahad. I suppose I first wanted to ask you how you got into cryptozoology, because it's a really, you know, strange subject for those looking in from the outside.
Yeah, there's not many of us, I guess, fully committed to this endeavor. But people ask me that a lot. It wasn't a planned career path. It was just something that I've been passionate about my whole life. When I was a young boy, I remember watching a television show about Bigfoot, and I was captivated. And so I went down to the library and read every book I could get my hands on, learned about, of course, Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, the Yeti. Those were kind of the prevalent cryptids or mystery creatures at that time. And through the years, I've just been very interested in the subject. And as I got older, I had some opportunities to work with other people that were doing field research here in Texas, where I live. And ultimately, I began to experience things that I just couldn't explain. And I was just kind of drawn in to the point where it kind of took over my life. And you know, it's a full-time passion/project.
Yeah. So then strange events, I mean, were they more paranormal then?
Well, no. I didn't interpret them that way. What I mean to say is that, for example, I was with a group and we were investigating evidence of Bigfoot or Sasquatch in the woods of East Texas, and began to hear vocalizations, sounds that I couldn't attribute to any known animal. They sounded very much like a primate. Began to find tracks or footprints that looked similar to the ones that are reported around the continent and the world, and also found other evidence, including these strange teepee-like structures in the woods that, you know, looked like they had been put together by something intelligent, but not man-made. They were more like animal nests or primate nests, really. So just kind of a culmination of that. Also some mutilated animal carcasses. So, you know, if you go into, when you start going into areas where there are a lot of sightings and you find kind of weird evidence that you can't attribute to any known species, and that's pretty significant.
Absolutely. So I suppose, like, here, you know, you are a prolific writer in all this as well, so you've covered most, you know, cryptids. I mean, no, you mentioned Loch Ness at the beginning there. I mean, is that something you still believe in? I mean, because I'm like you, you know, I got into it, like, I opened the book on Loch Ness and all that, and that got me into it. But obviously, left Loch Ness and that mermaid, that kind of stuff, I've left that kind of behind and moved on to, you know, like you say, the Bigfoot and that kind of stuff. I mean, is that the same for you, or do you still hold a little soft spot for the old Loch Ness?
Oh, I absolutely do. One of the epiphanies of my life when I was growing up is that I vacationed at Loch Ness when I was 15 years old. My family traveled over to Europe, and that was one of the spots where I stayed for about a week. And I guess that was my first attempt at field research, because I was interviewing a lot of the locals and people who claimed to have seen it and seen something. And I had a little movie, 8mm movie camera that I carried along with me. I was always hoping to get that, you know, famous groundbreaking footage, which I didn't. But yes, I'm absolutely fascinated with the Loch Ness Monster still. I think the main thing to consider is the big picture, which is that things like Nessie have been reported in similar lakes all over the world, in Canada, Ireland, Russia, Iceland, Japan, you know, even in Argentina, in some of these cold glacial lakes. And the physical descriptions of these mystery animals, these cryptids, are quite similar from place to place. And those also match very well, of course, with the enduring stories and legends of so-called sea serpents, which, you know, date back centuries. So I think all of that taken, you know, in its entirety is a pretty strong indicator that there are some large unknown aquatic animals out there. And I think that those animals might be responsible for the sightings of Nessie. Now, whether Nessie is a full-time inhabitant of the lake, I think that, from a biological point of view, I think that's the problematic thing, since there are so many visitors to the lock each year, so many cameras trained on the lock, and of course, people have also discussed the issues in terms of food supplies, you know, fish stocks and things like that. So perhaps whatever is being seen is something that's traveling back and forth to Loch Ness and other lakes from the ocean. That's what I think might be happening.
Yeah. Well, I was talking to Andy McGrath last week about the Loch Ness Monster, and I mentioned that there's been a couple of reports of people seeing it actually on land.
Yeah.
I mean, have you heard anything like that elsewhere?
Oh, you mean, and so with regard to some of the other lake monsters?
Yeah, actually, like, you know, walking from one lake to the other, or, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I know with regard to Champ, or the Lake Champlain Monster, here in the northeastern United States, there's a researcher named Dennis Hall who claims that he saw Champ kind of on the shore, and that's what kind of got him involved in doing research years ago. Other than that, you know, I'm not really thinking of, or I'm not really recalling too many sightings. I think with regard to Russia, I think Lake Labinkir, I think, where they've had sightings, I think there were some scientists that were doing an investigation. It's a very remote lake. It's kind of in Siberia, back in the 70s or 80s, and they claimed that they saw this thing on the shore in the shallows. But, you know, by and large, really not too many sightings. And I know with regard to Nessie, I mean, most of the land sightings are kind of old, aren't they? They date back to the 1930s and such. There's a famous one from the 1950s. But not so many in modern times, as far as I'm aware. So I guess that is problematic when you consider that these things are not seen on land very often. So that would certainly limit their mobility if that's the case.
Yeah. I mean, the land thing just gives the creature another dimension to me, but that's why I'm interested in it. But let's look at some of the more outlandish cryptids then, because there's a few that get, you know, they sort of spring up and then die down. And some, you know, there's mistaken identity, all this kind of stuff. And a lot of these, you know, the skeptics will say it's mistaken identity, that kind of stuff. But obviously, a lot of these cases are not that, especially when you've got trained people looking at, you know, these creatures and saying, this is not what I saw. But the chupacabra, I know you've looked into this, and obviously now, if you mention chupacabra to anybody, they're going to say it's a mangy coyote. But the initial descriptions of this beast, sorry, the initial descriptions of this beast don't sound anything like a coyote. So, I mean, where do you stand on the chupacabra nowadays?
Well, chupacabra, like many other cryptids, I think tends to be a situation where you have what we call composite identity. That means essentially there are several different animals or things that are involved, and perhaps, you know, I'm not saying that there are a variety of mystery beasts that look like the chupacabra, because that would be hard enough to accept. But for example, with regard to the original descriptions of the chupacabra from Puerto Rico in the 1990s, people described this kind of small bipedal kangaroo-shaped animal with kind of a reptilian appearance and, you know, a row of spikes going down its back, large eyes, and so forth. But as the sightings continued and proliferated throughout Central and South America and Mexico, then people began to describe something that had wings. That was called a chupacabra, kind of a bat-like creature. And then, as you mentioned, here in the States, we began to find evidence of these strange canid-like animals that, you know, we actually have pretty strong evidence that they are just weird-looking canids, and those were called chupacabras. So it's kind of it's a name, I guess, that's been attached to a lot of different phenomenon. I guess that's what I'm trying to say, or used in a lot of different ways. The name chupacabra is kind of in... When you head south of the border here in Texas, it kind of becomes a catch-all phrase for basically monster or, you know, boogeyman type thing. So
like demon.
Yeah, it's kind of like that. You know, it's just kind of a. But where I stand these days, there's actually there's very little evidence that there is a vampire-like predator. This, you know, stalking the. Farms and ranches and drinking the blood of its victims. Very little evidence of that. Some allegations, but that's about it. But with regard to these strange, you call them mangy coyotes, but I think we can go a step further and say that we definitely have these hairless canids. They're not all coyotes. Some of them have turned out to be wolf coyote hybrids or domestic dog coyote hybrids or hybrids of different kinds. But they are canids, but they're essentially hairless, and they have many of them have had strange teeth or dentition, growths on their body, sort of disproportionate limbs and other physical abnormalities. So, I mean, can that really all be attributed to mange? I'm currently working with a scientist, in Switzerland, who's been taking DNA samples from so-called chupacabras or similar animals from the Ukraine. And he's come to some amazing finds in terms of, you know, finding that the DNA samples from hairs and things don't really match up with anything known in the canid world, that they are very distinct and different from wolves and coyotes. So that, in conjunction with the physical abnormalities that I've seen, at least indicates that we might have a very unusual, I guess you could call it a mutation, you know, something that's springing up with some of these feral dog populations around the world. And, you know, I wonder if that it might not be attributed to environmental factors, things like pollution and so forth.
Yeah, yeah. It's possible. I mean, if you see them running around with three eyes, we'll know for sure, won't we? So, okay, so another cryptid that you've spent a lot of time on, and this is one that don't get talked, you know, talked about nearly enough, is the flying cryptids. And I mean, these go way back to like the Thunderbird, that kind of stuff. I mean, is that something what you know, people are seeing today? Do you think this is still the same creature that we was talking about back then, or do you think we're looking at two or three different types of creature here?
No, I absolutely think there is mounting evidence that there is at least one type of large, unknown flying animal out there. And it most certainly is the same thing that Native Americans talked about in terms of the Thunderbird. The Thunderbird legend is a prevalent legend throughout Native America cultures. It spans from the Pacific Northwest to the American Southwest, the Great Plains, the New England, and pretty much everywhere. So you have these totems and that depict these giant birds on the top, and then you have the native legends. But what's really interesting is, you know, are the modern eyewitness sightings. And because of my because of the fact that I've focused on reports of flying cryptids, I've kind of become a lightning rod for those types of reports, and I'm contacted on a fairly frequent basis by people who are adamant that they've seen something unknown, something very large. I guess the challenging thing as a researcher is that the physical descriptions don't always line up. For example, there are many people who describe these things as looking essentially like giant birds with feathers, like sort of like a giant vulture or an eagle, a raptor type of bird with a hooked beak, very powerful. And then other people have described these things as looking like something entirely different, basically winged animals that don't have any feathers and have kind of leathery or scaly skin. And those descriptions line up very well with the prehistoric flying reptiles known as pterosaurs, which presumably went extinct 65 million years ago. But many people I've interviewed are adamant that that's what they've seen, or that's what they think they've seen. So that's kind of a really startling part of that mystery. And then kind of on the fringe of that phenomenon, you have sightings of the so-called Mothman and other flying humanoids, which don't sound like anything physical or natural in origin. And those accounts, even though people are describing large winged creatures, really seem to indicate something more supernatural, something less physical in nature.
So supernatural, yeah. I mean, I know, because like the Mothman, like when that gets brought up, a lot of people go to Alien for that. I mean, where do you stand on that kind of speculation?
Well, I wrote a book, Encounters with Flying Humanoids, Mothman, Man-Birds, Gargoyles, and Other Winged Beasts, where I dedicated, first of all, there was a kind of a global look at the Mothman / flying humanoid phenomenon. And, you know, the physical descriptions of these creatures, which are not in any way consistent, you have different physical descriptions from around the world. The common denominator being sort of a humanoid shaped form with wings attached, for the most part. And of course, that description really does not have any basis in science, in zoology, in the fossil history. In evolutionary terms, you can't have a humanoid with wings. The evolution did not happen that way. So, you know, and then there are these other strange aspects to that mystery as well. You know, with regard to Mothman, many people describe the Mothman as traveling at impossible speeds without flapping its wings, having large glowing eyes that would put people in sort of a hypnotic trance. Many people who have sighted flying humanoids or encountered them have post-traumatic situations. Some have even experienced illness and even poltergeist activity, hearing strange sounds, smelling strange things. And then you have the whole Men in Black element, where people claim that they've been visited and threatened by mysterious non-human beings. So, I mean, it's a multifaceted, it's a fascinating mystery, and it's multifaceted. But it doesn't indicate any type of flesh and blood living animal. It seems to be something that's, you know, more spectral in nature.
Mm. So these creatures, you know, again, they pop up all over the world. This is not just, you know, an American thing or mm-hmm. you know, European thing. It's, you know, it's an Asian thing. It's all over the world. So does that give it more credence, or, you know, does that almost put it into the, this could be the imagination of man, because, you know, because it crops up all these places? Or do you think because it crops up all these places, that gives it more credibility?
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, you could look at it two completely different ways. It's a very polarizing possibility. Either these things are real and they exist, and it's a valid phenomenon that humans all over the world are experiencing and have been experiencing for hundreds and thousands of years, or there's something about the commonality of humans, something that we share, kind of a global consciousness, and that we have, as humans, we have shared perceptions and perspectives of at times, and that this notion of a flying humanoid or a winged man or winged humanoid is such powerful imagery that it's something that we humans share globally, you know, and something that we've incorporated into our mythos and our legends and folklore and so forth.
Do you think that, you know, because it's, you know, almost conjured up by people like a tulpa, do you think, you know, that's possible?
No, certainly.
Well, it's just that these sightings, you know, tend to have like a little short period of time, don't they? Sort of happen for a few weeks or so and then stop all of a sudden.
That's true.
Sorry?
Is our call still going there, Lee? It looks like it dropped on my end.
Yeah, I think it's still going, yep.
Oh, okay. My bad. I don't think you can edit that out, sorry. One of my good friends and colleagues, Nick Redfern, who's written a number of excellent books on unexplained phenomena, he's a huge proponent of the tulpa theory, and I'm sure your listeners or many of your listeners are familiar with that, but the concept that we are able to, and you know, this stems from a Buddhist belief, Buddhist monks living in remote monasteries, very spiritual men, that claimed that they could actually create physical sentient beings with the power of their mind, essentially projecting these beings from their imagination into our physical world, simply with the power of meditation in the mind. And you hit a key point there, and so has Nick in terms of speculating that, you know, maybe our minds are more powerful than we ever imagined, that we are able to essentially, when we start talking about these things like the Mothman or envisioning them and then talking about them, that it kind of breathes life into them, and that they do become so physical creatures or physical things, at least for a short time. And the point you make is excellent, that, you know, that would explain why they have very short lifespans in terms of, you know, when they're around and so forth. I think that could potentially explain all manner of mystery creatures that don't fit into the natural world. And that could include the flying humanoids. It could include the so-called dogman or werewolves, mermaids, and all types of kind of man-beast hybrids.
Absolutely. You brought up dogman there. I mean, a lot of reports of the dogman seem to have some sort of supernatural element, although the creature itself seems to be, in general, physical. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar. It almost parallels the Mothman and the flying humanoid accounts in many ways. Admittedly, Dogman is not a strong area of my research, but I, of course, correspond with Linda Godfrey, who's a researcher and writer here in the United States, and she's documented so many accounts. And yes, many of them seem to take on a very macabre and almost paranormal element in terms of the you know, these are physical creatures, as you indicate, but there are other related phenomenon, you know, people, things that people experience in conjunction with these dogmen creatures. And some of it, again, you know, poltergeist activity, almost like a residual haunting type stuff. Strange green shrouded mists that move around, glowing orbs and lights that kind of bounce around, things like that. The glowing eyes, which are often reported on many of these creatures, which is not really, you know, we're not talking about light being reflected. We're talking about self-illuminating red eyes, which is not something that you really find in nature, at least not in vertebrates. So,
I mean, they,
yeah,
they,
it's weird.
Just the point on the eyes. I mean, you know, from an evolutionary standpoint and all the rest of it, for a predator to have glowing red eyes doesn't really make a lot of sense, does it?
No, you'd kind of be alerting your potential victims to the fact that you're around.
It's like a sightseeing,
you know?
I'm here.
Yeah, unless like the Mothman, you're able to maybe hypnotize or put people in put victims in a trance, which, you know, that's just, yeah, it's inconceivable. It's really weird, and you know, there is a certain percentage of Bigfoot accounts also that, you know, where you get those kind of weird glowing eyes accounts and, you know, orbs and things like that. But as I often point out to people, the percentage of Bigfoot reports that include that stuff is very, very minuscule. So almost not worth considering. But with regard to dogman and flying humanoids, and dogman in particular, I think is a fine tulpa candidate when you consider how dogman seemingly came out of nowhere in recent years, and now they're being sighted all over, not only North America, but I'm getting sightings from South America and Europe and Australia as well. So it seems to be something that's, once it entered the public consciousness, it just started appearing everywhere,
which gives it that tulpa, tulpomancy sort of aspect again. But there's a couple of theories that I've got for that, and one of them is that, like you just say, the more people that talk about it, and the more people that have seen it talk about it, because of the ridicule factor, and that, so that could be one aspect. Then you've got the deforestation, you know, as we encroach on their territory, we, you know, are more likely to bump into them. And then you've got the third theory, if you like, which is the one that says, and I don't know where you stand on this, and this is just a far-fetched theory, but there's a theory that the government know about Bigfoot and they're actively seeking and killing Bigfoot. But if you're removing Bigfoot and these keeping the numbers of dogmen down, then obviously you're going to get an explosion of dogmen by doing that. So it's the rule of unattended consequences, I guess. But, I mean, which of those do you think is more likely, if any?
Well, again, I'd say the tulpa theory, and the reason I bring it up is because, again, I don't view dogman as a evolutionarily viable species.
No.
There's canids and all carnivores, and the, you know, the lineage that primates evolved from. I mean, you know, we diverged from a common ancestor like 50 million years ago, but those were two paths that were radically different, you know. Carnivores and canids obviously evolved into a very specific niche as quadrupeds and as predators, and then primates, of course, we went through a completely unique path as well, and then there was quite a wide divergence there. So I don't see that as being physically viable. You brought up an interesting point though about, you know, kind of the conspiracy theories and so forth, and you know, I'll always acknowledge that anything is possible, but I'm really not I'm not much of a proponent when it comes to conspiracy theories, and particularly conspiracy theories that involve the quote-unquote government.
Yeah.
Because our government over here is extremely inept and unable to really do anything correctly or well. And so when you talk about conspiracies that involve cover-ups and people keeping their mouths shut and, you know, particularly over long periods of time, it just, you know, it just doesn't seem to ever happen, at least not with regard to anything else. So why would Bigfoot or UFOs or anything else be the exception, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, I have to go along with that as well. It does sound a bit incredible, doesn't it? But, you know, like you say, I know it's not reported in many cases, but these trailing orbs, or these, you know, people see orbs before they see the Bigfoot, or they've got Bigfoot on the property and then these orbs come around. I mean, do you think the two are interconnected, or do you think it's just coincidence that they're in the same place, same time kind of thing?
I think the vast majority of Bigfoot reports, and this would apply also to the Yeti and the Yeren and the Alma, the Yowie, all the different wild men around the world, that we are definitely dealing with relict populations of hominids, man-like forms that from, you know, an earlier time that have basically survived in small numbers, small but viable numbers into the present times. I think that most of the evidence points in that direction. But I think there's most certainly, or at least there seems to be, a fringe section of those of the phenomenon that seems to be more paranormal in nature, and that's when you get into these weird accounts of you know, Bigfoot and UFOs, or, you know, floating orbs, tracks that disappear, trackways that disappear in the middle of you know, a field, vanish into thin air, and things like that. I haven't investigated too many sightings like that, but some of my colleagues have, and, you know, at least dating back to the 1970s, some really weird Bigfoot sightings from Pennsylvania and other places that, you know, at least present that possibility that maybe there is a phenomenon similar to what we're dealing with the tulpas, with the Dogman and Mothman, that portend to these giant, hairy, ape-like creatures as well, these hominid-type things, you know? Maybe there are a section of Bigfoot sightings that could relate to tulpas, if those things exist.
I mean, I suppose Bigfoot is a strange cryptid in a way, because he does leave evidence.
Yeah, I'm looking at evidence right now. On my desktop here, I have probably about a dozen casts, plaster casts of tracks that have been made at different times and in different places across North America. And they share many common attributes that seem to indicate they came from the same species. But they also display different sizes and slight variation, very subtle variations that would indicate diversity within a species. Scientists, some researchers who are much smarter than I am, who are actual physical anthropologists, have studied these footprints extensively, these casts, and have determined that they belong to a totally natural biological foot of an upright, very heavy, very massive biped, a primate, and that the foot structure is very different from humans. And so, you know, there's a lot of information out there if people want to delve into that a bit more. But it's pretty strong evidence, really. And a lot of scientists haven't even wanted to really look at it. But as I said, a few who have, who've been bold enough to kind of stick their neck out there. And if you're interested in Bigfoot, I'm sure you've heard the names, Dr. Jeff Meldrum, Dr. Grover Krantz, and so forth. Yeah. They build a pretty strong case that these casts are, you know, fairly convincing evidence. And it's a shame that more scientists haven't taken a look at them.
I think it's strange that the Bigfoot, his foot is, you know, almost looking more human than it would look, you know, like a gorilla's foot, the toe structure. So,
yeah,
do you think he is some sort of lost relative of ours, or do you think he's just come up from a completely different branch altogether?
Well, I think it's definitely a hominid. You know, it if it walks on its two legs, even though it seems to have a very different foot structure and maybe evolved bipedalism in a very different way than we did, I would say it is most definitely a hominid because it walks on its hind legs. People that have seen them up close describe their faces as looking surprisingly human-like, or a mixture of human and ape-like characteristics. It seems that they're very intelligent, which is, I think, the main reason why we haven't found them yet, because they are very aware of us. They have heightened senses and apprehension when it comes to humans, Homo sapiens, and perhaps they view us as their primary competition, you know, competing for the same niche. So they've therefore chosen to live in very remote areas that we don't go to, travel at night, when we're not mostly not around, mostly not out in the woods, to stay nomadic. You know, all of those things would really be the only way you could explain how they've managed to stay hidden from us. And that's if they are very intelligent and they intend to stay hidden from us. So yes, in that respect, I'd say, and you know, furthermore, if you look at our fossil history, things that looked rather like Bigfoot or Sasquatch did exist. We know definitively did exist hundreds of thousands and even, you know, up to a couple of million or a few million years ago, kind of quote unquote ape men, you know, right. Kind of characteristics of both, some very primitive characteristics and also sort of derivative or modern characteristics combined. So, yes, I think that all things point in that direction. Mm.
And the other thing about Bigfoot, again, is he's seen all over the world in different guises, but, you know, a similar sort of creature. So what?
Yeah, further evidence that they're hominids, because yeah. what's the only animal you can find on every continent?
Indeed, yeah. So what about giants? Is that something you've run across?
My problem with giants, you know, and a lot of these accounts of giants that I've heard about, is that physiologically speaking, because of our design, which we were just kind of talking about a bit there, I don't think you can really increase the size of a humanoid much larger than, you know, say 8 feet tall without creating a lot of structural issues. The weight of a biped increases, I forget what the ratio is, but increases rather dramatically when you start adding inches in height.
Yeah.
And, you know, look at the tallest human that ever lived, a guy named Robert Wadlow. He was born in Alton, Illinois in the 20th century. He only lived to his early 20s because it got to the point where he couldn't even really walk without leg braces. He couldn't feel his lower extremities. And ultimately he had a foot injury and got an infection because he couldn't, you know, he couldn't move around very well, essentially. So this notion of a humanoid form standing 9, 10, or even 12, 15 feet tall or taller, I just don't think that works from a physiological standpoint. I don't think something that tall would be able to walk around on two legs without putting an immense amount of pressure on his or her lower extremities.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, it's the same for spiders, I've been told. Yeah. They can only grow to a certain size, otherwise they'd actually suffocate.
Yeah.
They can't move oxygen around, you know, the body efficiently if they get, you know, any bigger than they do now. So that's
and they also
good if you don't like spiders, I suppose.
And their muscles don't become functional anymore because they're not strong enough to carry their mass.
What's the strangest cryptid, then, you've been sent to investigate?
Well, there were some pretty weird ones. I hosted a TV show, Missing in Alaska, and we investigated reports of a mermaid-type creature known as the Quala Pollock. And it's a Native American legend, an Inuit legend, that essentially describes, very similar to mermaid legends around the world, kind of an aquatic, fully aquatic creature that combines humanoid characteristics with the lower extremities of a fish or you know, some type of fin. That was a pretty weird, those were pretty weird stories when we were up there investigating that. Again, Mothman and other flying humanoid accounts that I've investigated are pretty strange. When you consider the physical descriptions, that people have, logged and, sketched out. And Dogman, you know, I have investigated a couple of Dogman accounts. And again, it's, all of those are kind of in that same, I put them in kind of the same file folder together, kind of a dossier of really weird, weird creatures. There are some good ones in my new book. My new book, A Menagerie of Mysterious Beasts, I actually dedicated a few accounts in the last chapter to, like, the black-eyed children, which, you know, probably more of a paranormal phenomenon. It's pretty creepy. Mermaids and, you know, fairies and, no, you know, I come across those kind of really weird accounts from time to time, but it's not something that I necessarily devote a lot of time and effort into, but I do enjoy reading about them and perhaps filing them away into my little, box here.
Cool. So, right, two questions then. I guess these are the final two questions, but this is which cryptid do you think will be proved? Or let's rephrase that, most likely to be proved in our lifetime, say.
Oh, that's a great question. I actually think there's two candidates that are kind of running head to head. One is called the Orang Pendek, or yeah, Little Man of Sumatra, which is a diminutive hominid, kind of a Littlefoot type creature that's been reported from the remote regions of Mount Kerinci and some of those other areas in western Sumatra. Sumatra is obviously a continent, or I'm sorry, an island that has yielded a number of animal discoveries in recent years. Some of the most, some of the richest biodiversity in the world, and there's certainly, I think, there's a possibility that there's some type of either bipedal ape or diminutive hominid living in those remote areas. I haven't had, unfortunately, had the opportunity to go over and do their research myself, but Adam Davis and Richard Freeman and some other colleagues of mine that have been over there are quite convinced that this thing is real. I think the other candidate would be the quote-unquote Tasmanian tiger or thylacine, the carnivorous marsupial that's been reported from the island of Tasmania and Australia. And, of course, we know that thylacines were native to Tasmania at least until 1936 when the last one died in captivity. But since that time, there have been hundreds of sightings by reputable people in Tasmania, including park rangers and wildlife experts. Their existence in Australia is a little bit harder to accept, although it's possible that some thylacines were taken to mainland Australia from Tasmania before they went extinct, and perhaps they are living in small viable populations there as well. So I think both of those cryptids, either or of those cryptids, may turn out to be the real thing, maybe hopefully within my lifetime.
I hope so, yeah. I think that one, yeah, they get enough reports of that one to make you think that there could be something to it. But, you know, if not that, then there's something that looks very similar out there running around. But, okay then, so, you know, that's the ones you think might get proved. What about if you could choose one for you to prove, you know, you actually could capture one, which would that be?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, obviously, my focus of my research for many years has been on the flying cryptids, what we talked about earlier, the Thunderbirds. Mm. I think that obviously finding something like Bigfoot or Sasquatch or the Yeti would, I think, have the greatest impact on human kind in terms of, you know, cultural changes. I mean, because we are talking about something that's presumably very close to us.
Yeah.
Or closer to us than any other animal on the planet. But I think I would love to prove that there is some type of giant flying cryptid out there that is much larger than anything known, I think that would be pretty remarkable, actually, to consider that there's something that has been flying through the air, perhaps for thousands or millions of years, that scientists have not documented. And it's probably, you know, when I explain it like that, it's probably very unlikely now that I think about it, because something that would be very large, which is what people are describing, that's flying through the air, you think that there would be a lot more sightings, a lot more photographs and evidence. And we really don't have any physical evidence of these flying creatures at all. No one has come across a giant feather or egg or a nest or anything like that, or even a giant pile of bird crap. So, but yeah, I think proving that any of these flying cryptids, well, actually, any of them, I'd take any of them, Lee, honestly, man.
I'd take any, but
I'll take, just to open people's minds. And I think that's one of the most rewarding aspects of being a cryptozoologist or an investigator and researcher of the unknown is, just getting people to open their minds, even just a little teeny bit, and consider the possibility that there are things in this modern world that we don't quite understand yet.
Do you think that's arrogance?
Do you think it's arrogance which way?
Like human arrogance, that we know everything about everything.
Oh yeah, that attitude, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, how often now are we proven wrong when it comes to, just think about how much the science books and history books have been rewritten in recent years as things came to light, and old, long-held theories have been overturned by new findings and discoveries. The technology and research and so many things are advancing, DNA research, so many things are advancing these days that, I feel it is very arrogant to presume that we know it all at this point. And I don't judge people that have that attitude, but I just find it hard to understand myself that people could feel, that confident that we do know anything at this point, really.
Yeah. I mean, we've done that. We did that with coelacanth. We did that with the panda, the silverback. We told the locals they don't know what they're talking about. To some extent, the same with orang pandek. We're telling the locals who see this thing regular that it can't be possible. I do find that a tad arrogant.
Yeah, and on that, if I can, just a quick follow-up on that, Lee. In the past few weeks, it was announced that a new species of orangutan has been described in Sumatra.
Yeah, was that just based on DNA?
Yeah, it was. So, I mean, it perhaps sounds a bit more fabulous when you first say it. But yes, scientists knew about this kind of isolated population of orangutans for a long time.
Yeah.
But through DNA testing, they were finally able to conclusively say that they are genetically distinct. Probably diverged about 70,000 years ago from other orangutan species in Sumatra. But, just those kinds of findings, I think, illustrate that point that, I think years ago, if you had asked scientists how many species of orangutans there were, that, they probably would have, said, well, maybe just one or two. But now we're up to four that are genetically distinct. And so, it's all part of the process of discovery and exploration.
Absolutely. Well, I hope that something does turn up in the not-too-distant future, because I think it'd be amazing. But, I just want to thank you for your time. I know you're really busy, so it's been great talking to you.
Well, thank you, Lee. It's definitely been an honor talking to you this evening, and hopefully we can do it again real soon.
Yeah, and do you just want to tell people where they can find your work? Because, like you say, you've got plenty of interesting books. There's a book there. If you're into cryptozoology, there's a book there for you for sure. So do you want to tell people where you can find them?
Yeah, I appreciate it. I have a website, which is kengerhard.com. People can also find me on Facebook, Ken Gerhard Cryptozoologist. And, of course, all my books are available online at major book retailers. My newest one is called A Menagerie of Mysterious Beasts. And it's got a pretty diverse range of topics. I think something for everyone. So if anyone out there is interested, I would check it out.
Great stuff. Well, thank you again, mate. And I'm sure we'll speak again.
Sounds good, Lee.
Cheers, mate. Talk to you soon, man. Have a good Christmas.
All righty. Sounds good. Cheers.
Well, they've gone. Though, just for now. It wasn't the right time for us to meet. But there'll be other nights. Other stars for us to watch.
They'll be back.